You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you have a question about your animal's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls, we have another special topic to share, Patricia.
That's right. You know, monkeys can be sneaky about keeping food away from other monkeys, but it turns out they are not just fooling around. There's some new research that tells us that these primates are getting down to monkey business, and we will find out why, in a few minutes.
Okay. And if you've ever been enchanted by a cardinal's croon or a swallow's serenade, then you'll want to stay tuned for today's interview. We'll be talking with Don Kruidsma. He's the author of The Singing Life of Birds, and he's brought some sound bites to share with us, too. Before we get to that, however, it's time for your calls at 1-800-462-7413, and let's take our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Dennis Scirocco from Memphis, Tennessee.
Dennis from Memphis, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you so much for taking our call. And your show just started in Memphis, so we're very excited about it, and I really appreciate taking my call.
WKNA, I bet.
That's right.
All right, thank you.
Well, I have a naughty cat, and we hope that you can help us out.
Well, we'll try. What's up with your cat?
Well, Tampi, we inherited her about 6 months ago, and she's been a fantastic cat up until, I would say, about a couple weeks ago.
Really?
Yes. We work, and my wife and I come home in the evenings, and what she started doing is continuously meowing when we show up home.
Hmm.
We really don't understand what could be happening with her, so we wonder what you may have for us as far as advice goes.
Here's my best guess. If she was a vocal cat to begin with, and this has gradually been getting worse, my guess is that, as is often the case, she's a great animal trainer, whereas you might be a good animal trainer. You know, our pets are so good at being great observers and having a lot of stamina because, let's face it, what else do they have to do?
Yeah.
All day long, right? So it's very often true that we will completely inadvertently sort of get sucked into these scenarios where they start doing something that gets attention more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
When she meowed originally, would you try and figure out why? Would you go to her food? Would you pet her? Would you give her attention? What would you do?
Oh, yeah, nonstop. We would just treat her like a queen.
Well,
you know, whatever she wanted.
Yeah.
If she wanted us to take her to food, we did that. If she wanted us to open the door for her, we did that.
Well, here's what you do. You have me come live in your house, and you treat me like that.
You would love it.
And then I'll work with your cat. But if you'll get me whatever I want, whatever I want, a little steak here, a little chocolate fudge sundae there, no, that. So, but, you know, this is a very common situation for all of us to be in. Believe me, you are not alone. There's a huge group of us out there. We've all been there. And here's what to do now, because now it's a little tricky because she's just gotten this habit. It just goes on and on and on. You can do one of two things. You can either completely ignore her meowing.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, you might even actively ignore it, such that when she meows, every time she does, you turn away from her and sort of walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if she's meowing continuously, that might
be a little
tough.
We'd be walking around the house all day.
You're never going to get to sit down anywhere. And so sometimes this advice about just ignoring a problem behavior, you know, it works for marine mammals who live in pools, you know, in a captive facility where you can pick up your bucket of fish and walk away. But if you live in the same house with them, sometimes it's not so easy. But certainly in general, mm-hmm. you want to be really careful about not reinforcing her whenever she meows. You can also be a little bit more active and actually do something, create some consequence for meowing that she's not really all that fond of. And you certainly don't want to scare her. I don't want you to interfere with your relationship with her. But you might want to try, a spray bottle, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my wife suggested that we have a little kid spray gun.
Okay.
And see, when we did that, you know, Tampi, our cat, runs away. And so maybe that's what you're suggesting. That's a good behavior to enforce.
You might want to try it. Some cats do better if you get one of a plant spritzer. It sort of has a bigger, misty kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't tend to get your carpet quite as wet. But the trick is to go out of your way to pay attention to her when she's quiet.
Mm.
So be sure if you're going to do one,
you
if
do
you do
the
negative, be sure that you put most of your attention in the positive. So try that and let us know how it goes.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you mentioned that marine animals, that bucket. You know, sometimes you're going to have to tell me how they actually train those marine mammals.
We should make that a topic. It's because it's the same basic principles that we should be using, we can be using, not just with our pets, but with our husbands, our wives, and our children.
And, we'll have to do that.
I want to
learn about marine mammals. You know, we've heard from listeners in the past who want to get rid of critters.
Often.
Like bats that hang around their house. And we received an email from a listener named Amy. She listens to Calling All Pets on KSKA-FM in Anchorage, Alaska. And she's got a different type of questions for you, and maybe you can help on this. She writes, "We used to have bats stay in the eave of our porch, and 2 years ago, my husband had to spray a bee's nest near the area where the bats used to live, and ever since then, we've not had any bats come stay with us. I miss them swooping down on us when we are leaving our house, not to mention the huge amount of bugs that they eat every night. What could I do to invite them back?"
Ooh, that's a wonderful story about the importance of being careful with those kind of pesticides.
Yeah.
You know, some of those pesticides, and believe me, I understand. I had a wasp nest right at the entrance to my barn, and I was stung so often and so badly, I finally just
couldn't do it.
Grinned and bared it and bought the can of of really strong pesticide and used it. But those are products that have profound implications for a whole range of animal life. I can't tell you, I don't know enough. I'm actually not qualified to tell you what it is exactly that's stopping the bats, whether that particular pesticide was a broad-ranging pesticide and therefore eliminated all of the insects in the area that the bats would feed on, or if the smell for some reason has pervaded the area and has repelled the bats. So I honestly don't know. I think what you might want to try is putting up some bat houses, put them in other places of your house that you think might be appropriate, and then sort of work your way back to the ports and see if that works. Larry, do you have any ideas?
I think it's probably the insects are going to blow back in within a very short period of time. With most pesticides that are on the market today, their effectiveness is over in fairly short order, but the smell could stay, and that might be a problem. So maybe you could do some cleanup. You might just dry washing and cleaning that area.
That's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
Yeah.
And maybe it just scared them away, and you know they
found
another place.
And you just don't have another little brown bat who wants a nest there. Yeah, try bat houses. See if you can attract them back.
And if you have a question for us, you can certainly email us as well.
Oh, we love to hear from you. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And, of course, we also love to hear from you by phone. That number is 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Michael from Madison.
Madison, Wisconsin. Michael, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I manage an apartment building in town, and the owners of the apartment building have decided to not allow cats and other four-legged pets in the building. So the reason behind this decision is that they believe cats in particular will at times use the carpet rather than their litter box, and replacing damaged carpet can cost $1,000 or more.
Oh, sure.
So I mentioned this to a friend of mine who is a very intense cat advocate, who has worked with the Humane Society and herself owns about 8 cats. And she told me very passionately that cats are the victims of a misconception here, that only cats that have been declawed have these problems, and that cats with claws will use their litter box. So I'm hoping you can settle this controversy and get to the bottom of this matter.
I can, but your friend is not going to be happy with me.
Okay.
Because I've worked with cats with problematic behavior for over 18 years now, and I can tell you without question that although there is some data that suggests that a percentage of cats who have been declawed, especially the old-fashioned way, which is basically an amputation of the last digit of the forepaws, There is some evidence that a percentage, and of course, what percentage is controversial, of those kind of cats can have litter box problems. There is absolutely no question that cats who have not been declawed can also have litter box problems. There are many, many reasons cats...
You've dealt with many of them.
We've dealt with... Larry has heard more litter box than he probably ever imagined in his life. There are many reasons cats go outside of the litter box. Sometimes it's just not kept clean enough. Sometimes the cats don't like the litter. Sometimes the cats have urinary infection. But I'm afraid it is only... The surgery is only one of the many reasons why cats don't agree with us about where they should go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
What I would hope is that apartment managers and owners, and I'm in business myself, so I'm very mm-hmm. sympathetic, but what I would hope is that they simply require larger security deposit from people who have pets than people who don't. And you could use that as a fund to, you know, pay for any damages that might occur.
That might occur. Yeah. That'd be one way to do it. That's actually not a bad solution.
And, you know, just this is a good opportunity, I think, to remind people who do have pets, who do rent or have their own homes, that if your cat stops going in the litter box or starts going somewhere else, the faster you deal with it, the better chance you have of turning it around.
Yeah.
And very often, sometimes it's a very simple solution. But if you wait a year or two or three, then it can get very, very hard. But if your cat goes outside of the box, pay attention. Don't just think it's going to go away and jump on it. Find the behaviors. Talk to your veterinarian. Get some books and try and do something right away. And you often can turn it around.
And, you know, the number of pet owners out there, I was thinking about this the other day. I had a smile on my face as I drove by an apartment with a big sign out front, "We love pet owners."
Yeah, smart apartment.
Smart apartment, you know, and I thought, boy, what a welcoming approach.
Absolutely. There's so many people. And, you know, cat ownership is very much on the increase. There are now more cats owned than there are dogs, almost 70 million or so.
So there's a market out there.
That's right. They need to live somewhere.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. When it comes to keeping food from competitors, we'll find out why some primates don't monkey around. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and we'll talk about that topic next on Calling All Pets.
Each week, Patricia and Larry give you great advice that helps you deal with your pet's behavior, but sometimes you want more. Do you want to go in depth into one of the pet topics you've heard on the show? Do you want more advice? More pet fun? Well, why not check out our website? It's callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. And today we have a new study to talk about regarding some sneaky monkeys. Is that right, Patricia?
That's right. This is a study by researcher Lori Santos and colleagues who found that rhesus monkeys understood the importance of being sneaky when getting food out of containers.
All right. Now, how did they find that out?
Well, they did an experiment, and in the experiment, the monkeys could get food out of one or two boxes. The boxes looked exactly the same. They were identical in appearance, but one box made a lot of noise when you opened it, and the other was silent.
Okay.
And they had the chance to get the food out of one or the other containers when they were in the presence of a, quote, competitor,
okay,
a person who was sitting on the beach with his head between his knees facing the ground.
Now, how far away was this person? Would he be able to hear if the boxes were opened? Or?
He would. He was he was very close to the boxes. So he could hear the boxes being opened, but he couldn't see anything because he wasn't looking at them. And the question was, would the monkeys choose the box that was silent in order to sneak into the box without alerting the competitor?
So what did they find?
Well, they found that 12 out of 14 subjects actually chose the silent container over the noisy one.
Kidding.
No kidding. However, and this was a good control, when the person had his head up and was looking at the monkeys did not choose the silent one more often.
Why is this an important finding?
Well, you know, it's a good question because, you know, sort of seems like it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's like,
it does.
Oh, yeah, you know, sort of intuitively expected result. But there's a big debate right now about whether non-human animals have what's called theory of mind. And theory of mind is not a theory at all, just to confuse things. It describes a situation in which an animal can understand that another individual has a mental experience just like they do.
Okay.
So it's about understanding what's going on in the minds of another individual.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of controversy about whether non-human animals can do this. Humans, it turns out, we can't do this until we're five.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we don't understand that sort of. It's like, you know, when a little kid is, you're supposed to hide from daddy, they'll mm-hmm. just, they'll hide their own head.
Yes.
Right?
Understood,
you know?
Yep.
So, but when we're five, we develop this theory of mind. And so there's a lot of controversy about whether non-human animals have it at all. And this study provides some very interesting and some pretty strong evidence mm-hmm. that some animals, at least rhesus macaques, mm-hmm. indeed do have an understanding that there's a lot going on between the ears of other individuals.
You know, I have a theory about phone numbers.
You have a theory?
What's going on in your mind, Larry? If I give a phone number,
yeah.
maybe people will call it.
I think that's a good theory. Let's test it out.
Let's test it out. Here's that number, 1-800-462-7413, the number for you to call us. And here's another caller. Hi, you're Ed Calling All Pets.
This is Dana calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Dana, it is most pleasurable to speak with you.
Well, thank you, and same to speak with you all.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a pet named Jake. He is a 7-year-old black lab. He's about 116 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a biggie.
Biggie.
And he always stays in the house, and he never chews anything. He's got his own chew toys and his ball, and he's just a perfect angel, typically. Well, about 3 weeks ago, he began to hate all of the screens in the house.
Ooh.
And he has clawed and chewed every screen out of the window in our house.
Oh, gee.
That's no good.
He did it in our RV, and then after my husband replaced all of the screens, he did it again. And my husband is ready to ship him off to Siberia because he's become somewhat unpredictable. So I was wondering if there was any explanation or anything that we should be doing differently to prevent him from being shipped off to Siberia.
Yes. Because if he claws and scratches his way out of Siberia, it's still a long way home, right?
Long way home.
Well, there is definitely an explanation. The question is whether we can figure out what it is. I mean, you're not going to have a dog go 7 years being polite and quiet in a house and then all of a sudden start desperately trying to get out.
Right.
So the question is what's causing it. And it could be separation anxiety, which is a kind of a phobia, which in some cases becomes at this extreme, really, really terrible. I've seen
even
dogs,
after 7 years of
yes,
not.
Phobias are strange. Phobias are things that start. We don't know how they start, but they can start what seemingly out of nowhere and then get very, very bad, very, very fast. The other possibility is that something is happening that you don't know about. And I've found one case, the National Guard changed their flight route and was flying directly, just very close to a house, going right overhead at like 3:30 every afternoon.
Huh.
Dog was absolutely terrified. Another case was there was an electric plant nearby that started up in the middle of the night, and we don't know if it was stray voltage or the sound, but the dog absolutely flipped out, and the dog had been fine for years and years and years and years. So one of the things for you to do is to try and figure out what's going on. You can leave a tape recorder. You can leave a video camera. You can sort of cruise by, sneak back to the house and see when he's quiet, when he flips out. If he has separation anxiety, he will probably start right away. Dogs with separation anxiety are usually the worst right after you leave. On the other hand, if something else is going on, he might be fine until 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something. So that's what you're going to need to do is do research, try and figure out what's going on. In the meantime, keep him somewhere where he can't hurt himself. And he's not going to destroy your house, and your husband's not going to send him to
Siberia.
Yeah, given how bad this is, I would suggest you talk to your veterinarian about something that truly calms him and soothes him rather than just makes him unable to move around a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Let us know what happens.
Yeah, for sure. Let us know. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Tondi in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Tondi, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have two wonderful male cats that I live with.
Mm-hmm.
And they are about 8 months apart, Clark being the oldest and Izzy being the youngest. And each of them has a little quirk that's kind of driving me crazy.
What do they do?
Well, Clark, he's got it seems like a runny nose to me. He's constantly rubbing his nose on my legs and on my feet, and he won't leave me alone.
Aww.
Hmm. I know, he follows me around, and I love him a lot, but I'm getting tired of it.
A little too clingy? A little too much love, maybe, perhaps?
Too much love, that's right.
Well, you know, you said you wondered if he had a runny nose. Does he have, you know, cats rub their noses, their cheeks against people as a sign of affection, but it's also possible there was something physical. Is there anything physical, do you think, or is this more about scent marking you because he likes you?
Yeah, I think it's more that, but it's becoming progressively more constant. And he's, you know, it's to the point where I can trip over him just to avoid stepping on him.
Is there any tension between these boys? Because, you know, that rubbing is scent marking, and it's very friendly and affiliative, but it is a way of saying, you are mine. So is there any tension between the two boys? Do you see any signs of sort of competition for
well,
you?
I do notice that when Izzy, the younger cat, is near me, and while I'm holding him, he's constantly looking around to see if Clark is watching.
Oh, that's an interesting factoid.
Uh-huh.
The behaviorist ears prick up. I wonder if that is partly what's going on. With that, one thing you might want to do is be sure to, since this is becoming problematic, is use that old standard behavioral formula of giving him attention when he's not begging for it. And you know, it's easy to say, it really is actually hard to do because you're so used to paying attention to them when they sort of get your attention, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
So it takes a little mental energy to do this, but I would try doing that. I would try increasing play. I think a lot of cats are sorely under-exercised, and they're so bored, and they just start doing what bored people do. They start getting into bad habits, so that's something else that would be important. And, you know, you could also try that appeasing pheromone called Feel-Away, and it's actually a synthetic replicate of what's produced by the scent glands in the cheek of an affiliative, calm, happy cat. So if the air is scented with that, he may feel less of a need to sort of create it himself. And you can just buy a little plug-in. And, you know, you need to think about how many rooms you have and how many plug-ins you need. But it's not very expensive, and you plug it in, and it's good for like 3 months or so. So you might want to consider trying Feel Away.
Give that a shot.
Yeah.
See what happens. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Coming up next, we'll take a look at the singing life of birds, and we'll also share some beautiful bird songs with you. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. If you need help with a multi-dog household, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444, or visit our website at callingallpets.org.
I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and that sound you heard is the sound of the canyon wren. It's one of several birds featured in Don Kreutzma's book. It's called The Singing Life of Birds. Don is a professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting fellow at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. And he joins us today to talk about his book, The Singing Life of Birds. Don Kreutzma, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry and Tricia. Pleasure to be here.
First of all, what's the difference between a bird song and a bird call?
Well, most of us know when we hear a bird climb to the top of the tree and just belt out something usually rather beautiful. And then there are these subtle little noises that birds often make in more close-knit quarters, like when a hawk is near or when a male and a female are near and communicating with each other. And usually it's the male who's in the top of the tree. But when it gets right down to it, some sounds are not easy to classify as to either songs or calls.
Oh, they're not?
Well, you take the cedar waxwing and a blue jay. They are both technically song birds, but we can't really easily identify any sound that they make that we would label a song. So it gets a little tricky. It's our human need to classify things as black and white songs and calls that sometimes gets us into a little trouble, but most of the time not.
Could you talk about how a bird's call differs based on the message they're trying to communicate to other birds?
Yeah, the calls that birds often communicate, you hear birds at a bird feeder in the winter, for example, and there's a lot of little subtle calls going on,
yeah.
And some expressions of who owns what and the dominance hierarchy among chickadees, for example. Or when a hawk flies over, you often hear birds give a high, thin call. And when youngsters are begging for food from the adults, or the female is demanding food from the male to feed herself so she can lay all the eggs, all of these little subtle communications, and males and females all give these kinds of calls. But when it comes to the songs, it's usually the male who is singing, and usually only during the breeding season. And I think of the song as 99% as being used to try to impress females to mate with him.
Well, that's a fine reason for a male to be
spending
some energy. And, you know, one of the things that we know about bird songs is it's the songs of some birds are very consistent and others are so variable. I know you did a lot of your research, actually, on these variable songs. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this is the spice of bird songs. Some birds do sing just one song over and over and over, like a chipping sparrow, a very common bird throughout North America. If you study their songs from one male, it's just that same song that he sings over and over and over. But then there are some birds that have enormous repertoires, like the brown thrasher, I think of as the king. He might have a couple of thousand different songs, and he probably makes some of them up as he goes. So. And then there are lots of other birds in between the one and the couple of thousand, like a song sparrow might have 10 different songs. And to me, part of the joy of listening to birds is realizing this variety and trying to listen on a little deeper level, because, boy, this song sparrow that has 10 different songs, think of all the choices he has with each song that he sings. What's he going to sing next? Which one will it be? And so that's the real joy of listening for me.
Yeah.
Are birds singing sometimes just for fun?
As I think of it, you know, we engage in activities like exercise or dare I say, just sex. And there's real physiological pleasure, endorphins that run through our body that make it enjoyable. And I would like to think that birds experience some of these same physiological feelings. Do they sing for joy? I don't see room for singing for joy. Although there might be some enjoyment, physiological or some kind, in the singing process, in a marathon performance well done, for example.
Mm. Some birds are so common to us that often we don't appreciate the intricacies of their calls, and I'm reminded of the American robin, which is the Wisconsin state bird, might be the state bird for some other states as well, I'm not sure. But what do you believe is the most important thing we should stop and think about the next time we hear a robin chirping in our backyard? And frankly, I'd like to hear the robin from your book as well, but maybe comment on that.
I sometimes get under the skin of birders because one of their main purposes is to generate a long list of species and come home at the end of the day and say, look, I checked off this many. And then my response to them is when they hear a robin, instead of saying, Well, there's a robin. Let's quickly move on to find something interesting, I'd say. There's a robin. Pull up a chair. It is extraordinary what you can hear from a robin if you simply slow down and you listen in ways that I try to teach people in the second chapter in my book. And no matter how complex the singer, I try to tell people there's always a handle, something unique that the bird does that you can grab onto and listen to. And then you listen for the bird to repeat that particular sound. And this little listening exercise takes you on journeys that you never would have thought possible. So three cheers for Wisconsin having a state bird as a robin.
Let's listen to the robin for a second.
Oh, yeah.
That's a pretty song. Talk about that song a bit.
That I know exactly which track that is in my book. I listen carefully, and what you hear if you listen carefully is you hear the bird give five phrases, and then he pauses. And then he gives maybe five or six more, and then there's another pause. But in that first five phrases, you listen to the third one, and to me that's a really unique one that just jumps out at me when I see a sonogram or when I listen to it. And I start to listen for that particular little z-z note, the third one, and then you start to hear it, do it during a whole sequence of phrases that the robin delivers, and you start to hear the pauses and the nuances, and after 30 seconds or so, that particular unique phrase will disappear because he's going to go on to a few others, and then eventually he'll come back to it. And so you hear when you stop and listen, truly listen, you hear this robin really opening up his mind and expressing what he's...
Well, let's hear it again.
Okay. There was the third one. Listen again. There it again. Two more times.
Yeah.
He ended with it there.
Yep, ended with it there.
That's great. And, you know, one of the things that your book points out that I think is reflected in listening to that robin song is that there are simple steps that listeners can take to start enjoying bird song more than they do. I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit more.
I think so many people are frustrated because they want to go out into the world and they want to put a label on everything that's singing. And to me, yeah, if you really want to do that, you can do that. But to me, it's much easier to get to that goal if you start with a robin and you become so familiar with that robin that, you'd never mistake it for anything else. And you become keyed into how to listen, too. I liken it to our making human friends. If we're going to live in a small community of 100 people, for example, we don't really start out like we do with the birds, with a field guide, with a list of names and faces. And no, we get to know one or two people at a time. And then a good day is never being able to just sit on a street corner and check off on a list how many people you could identify that walk down the street. No, you linger. You have lunch with somebody. You take a couple of hours And after you've done that, like with a robin, it never becomes an issue of identifying the robin because you have first identified with it. And to me, that's such a key difference in how you go about really connecting with what's going on around us.
Despite all the work and research that you've done for this book, The Singing Life of Birds, and in your career, is there anything you still don't understand about the bird song that you wish you did?
Larry, I could talk too long to that question. But perhaps the one single question, I would love to know how females evaluate males when the males are singing. That has to be, in my mind, that's 99% of the reasons that males sing. Most birds don't sing during the non-breeding season. They use calls, even if they're defending a territory. So all this singing, what cues are they using to judge males when the females are deciding who's going to be the father of their offspring?
What's your favorite bird call, and why?
Well, there are about 5,000 of those, Larry.
well, just name 3,000.
Yeah. The wood thrush. I think so many people in eastern North America, at least, are familiar with the wood thrush. And the joy of listening to them at dawn and at dusk when so few other birds are singing. And then when you realize how these wood thrushes are using their two voices simultaneously, you have to slow the song down to appreciate that.
Don, explain that to people, that birds can produce two songs or sounds simultaneously.
We humans have one voice box, and it sits at the top of our windpipe or trachea. But if you follow that windpipe down in birds and humans, there comes a place where you have a branch, a bronchus, going to each lung. And at the top of each one of those branches, most birds have a voice box. And those two voice boxes are independently controlled. And so, in essence, the bird can control the tension of the membranes that produce the sound and how much air is flowing through these two voice boxes independently. So a bird like this wood thrush, especially as you hear in the second half of the song when slowed down, this wood thrush is really singing a duet with itself. And just imagine if we could sing a duet simultaneously with ourselves, if we had two voice boxes. Think of the fun we'd have.
Think of the fun. And let's listen to that.
I think what I like especially is the contrast between the first part of the song and the second part. The first part is rich and clear and given slow enough that we can almost appreciate the musicality there. And then the second part, why, it sounds buzzy and noisy and like there's really not much there. So it's the contrast between those two parts of the song, and then successive songs are never the same. So he's just bouncing all over the spectrum, not only within a song, but between songs. And then, like the ultimate insult to us, our ears are so pathetic, we can't hear the real music of the wood thrush because that's in that second half of the song that sounds so buzzy or noisy to us. We have to slow it way down. And then I think we're hearing the song much like the birds themselves can hear the song.
And let's listen then at that slower speed, Don.
Great. And what we'll hear in this example, at a low pitch, we'll hear the right voice box giving a note, fairly slow rate. And then we'll listen to what the left voice box is doing at four times the rate of the right voice box. They're highly coordinated, but the sounds appear at very different rates. And then we'll hear the two together as the bird actually sings it, but at one-tenth normal speed. I could listen to that all day.
Oh, that's just amazing.
First the right, then the left, then you hear them together, and you realize, wow, that bird brain is controlling those two voice boxes to produce music like this. That's one of the least exciting of the songs that the wood thrush does. There are others that are just breathtaking.
And all of those are in the CD that accompanies the book.
That's right.
It's a wonderful book. And, Don, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
It's been great, Don.
Larry and Tricia, thanks very much.
Don Kreutzma is the author of The Singing Life of Birds. He spoke to us from his home in Amherst, Massachusetts. And if you want to learn more about The Singing Life of Birds, visit our website at www.callingallpets.org. We'll be taking more of your calls next. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do you have a question for Patricia? I know. Just call the 1-800 number, right? But you're shy, and the idea of talking on the radio gives you hives. So how do you get your question on Calling All Pets? We have a solution. It's called email. Send your pet behavior questions to pets@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Andrew from Athens, Georgia.
Andrew, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm having problems with my toy poodle. Recently, in the past few months, he started to put his paw in the water bowl and try to splash the water out and drink the water off the floor. We've had all different types of bowls, different materials, metal and plastic and everything. We've tried it in different locations, and every time he just wants to drink it off the floor. The only big changes he's had in his recently is he's been neutered. He's a 10-year-old dog.
Hard to imagine how that would affect drinking behavior, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Although it would in my book, be a big change.
Larry would be drinking more beer. Is that it, Mueller?
I don't know.
You've got every guy listening now.
I don't want to know either. I don't want to experience
Interesting
that.
You know, why is it that guys think about this, but women never think about having a hysterectomy when their dog is spayed? I don't get how that works. Well, I'll tell you, I don't know why your poodle either is playing with his water. It's interesting how many people call the show with problems with animals who are sort of rude with their water bowls, cats and dogs both. And I cannot tell you why your little dog is digging water out of his water bowl and licking it off the floor. It's very possible that it's some kind of a superstitious behavior, meaning that something happened when he was drinking out of a bowl and his brain categorized the problem as related to bowls.
Okay.
And even though it had nothing to do with bowls, just like your winning the baseball game had nothing to do with wearing the pink sock on your left shoe, you know, then you start getting conditioned to do it. And so it's very possible it's just simply one of those behavioral patterns that really doesn't have any sense to it, but it's because of some kind of superstition. Now, Larry's looking like he has some kind of a wild idea here.
Well, I don't actually don't have an idea, but Jill in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Another listener might have an idea.
Yeah, she sent us a pet tip telling us how she controlled her dog's drinking habits.
Okay, and related.
It's not quite the same as Andrew's here, but maybe her tip will help Andrew find a unique solution to his question as well. She says, my dog, Thule, used to gulp down water so fast that she would leave no water left for the other dogs, and she'd have an accident in the house just a few hours later. I loathe using mechanical devices, so I came up with my own solution to control the amount of water my dog was drinking. I have two large water bowls, and I alternate filling them and putting them in the freezer. Every morning, I picked up the old bowl, clean it, fill it halfway full of water, and put it in the freezer. I take the already frozen water out of the freezer, top it with fresh water, and set it out for the dogs.
Well, that's very interesting.
The dogs can drink the water only as quickly as the ice melts, but if they're really thirsty, they can lick the ice to get more water. And depending on how warm the weather is, by the end of the day, the ice is all melted. And, of course, on warm days, I'm careful to give them extra fresh unfrozen water so they stay refreshed.
Well, that's a very creative solution. This woman is thinking outside of the water bowl. That's very impressed. That's very interesting. And I'm glad she made the point that on a hot day she gives them extra water, because as we all remember from watching the shows about people lost in the Antarctic or something, you can actually die of dehydration by just eating snow and ice. Yeah. So you really need the actual water. But so she's come up with a great sort of middle ground there. But so for our friend in Georgia, for his toy poodle here, I would put the water bowl on a towel. I would try a container that has a narrow enough opening on the top that still needs to be pretty low. So you might want to get a low kind of a bowl, weight the bowl down, and then have a bowl with a cover, and then cut a hole that the dog can just get his muzzle in but can't really paw the water out.
Yeah.
Now, I have seen a little terrier who thought that was the greatest game in the world, because he could hook his paw inside of the cover and flip the whole thing up in the air. So he thought it was like a new game. Thank you so much. So that may get me in trouble in Georgia, but this is a great opportunity for listeners to help us out, because I need some help here. And clearly Andrew does. If anybody else has some good ideas about this, send an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And as a matter of fact, here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. Who are we speaking with?
This is Chuck from Wanakee.
Wanakee, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, yeah. Just down the road from you.
All right. Well, what can we do for you?
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about my crazy little paper-addicted cat.
Your paper-addicted cat?
Yeah, he's a four-year-old male tabby mix kind of that we got from the Humane Society about a year ago. And he's just got this awful addiction with paper. And what he does, it's not really harmful behavior necessarily. It's just kind of strange, and we're kind of trying to figure out why. But if you lay a piece of paper in the center of the floor, no matter where the cat is, he will head for that paper. He will lay on it, and he will protect it.
He'll protect it?
Yeah. Well, if you walk near him or anything, he kind of looks at you. If you start to kind of lean down and pet him or something, he might take a swipe at you.
No kidding.
But it's his paper, and you're not allowed near his paper. And, of course, this is only a problem when the kids are doing their homework.
Right.
And, you know, they're laying on the floor, and the cat decides to decide that the book is his place to be, and it makes it a little tough for the kids to finish the homework sometimes. But I just thought it's a very odd behavior.
You know, that's very interesting. Have you ever tried, you got this cat when he was older or when he was a kitten?
We bought him when he was about 3 years old.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I asked that is when you talked about him being attracted to paper, I just wondered if he'd learned to play with crumpled up pieces of paper. A lot of people play with their cats that way. It's the cheapest cat toy in the world. And as a lot of us know, cats, it's like, they don't care how much you spend on the toy.
Well, it's interesting, too, because it wouldn't matter where he is in the house. If you just, you could take a paper bag or a plastic bag or a piece of just plain white paper and just lay it there. And he's right on it.
You know, the other thing I thought of, because he's not, you know, it doesn't sound like he's attracted to crumpled up paper, is in my experience, it's really common for cats to love to lie on smooth, cool things, like pieces of paper. Yeah. I think a lot of us, I've had cats, and Sushi, my cat right now, will do the exact same thing. Is she loves to lie on the papers that I'm reading or grading. And I've always thought it was a lot about attention. So I think a lot of times cats will just lie right where your gaze is directed.
That's what I was wondering. I kept thinking, well, I wonder if it isn't because the cat sees you focused on something in front of you. They decide, oh, okay, that's a place for me to get attention.
I've seen that behavior that is so consistent with that interpretation. And I wonder if possibly this particular cat learned to do that. Just people are focused on the paper, so I'm going to lie there. You know, there's a lot of evidence that animals are well aware of the direction of gaze of another individual.
That makes sense.
So maybe that's what it was about. And then your cat sort of decided, you know, it feels good. It's sort of cool. I like it. And it's mine.
It's definitely his. Nobody's going to take his paper away.
thanks for calling, Chuck.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Jen from Boscobel, Wisconsin.
Hey, Jen, thank you for calling.
You bet, thank you.
What can we do for you?
Well, we have three cats and a dachshund. And you'd think that I'm calling about the wiener dog, but I'm not. Our youngest cat, Jim, is about 9 months old, and it's the strangest thing. When we take fresh laundry out of the dryer, if we're not careful, he'll come and urinate in it.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh.
How nice
it is. It is. It's nice. Yeah, I just clean the clothes, dry them, and then there's cat urine.
Sort of a value-added product kind of
concept. It's kind of smelly stuff, too.
Oh, cat urine is not a favorite amongst most humans anyway. I don't know. Maybe there's some culture out there, but I have yet to hear about them that puts cat urine on their wrists on a date. So tell me what you've done so far.
Well, we have yelled at him.
Right, and that's working, right?
And actually, I don't know if it's an animal behavior problem or if it's a human behavior problem.
Why?
We have done laundry when he's asleep because he's not right there.
Right.
And tried to put the laundry up on a table. So actually, I think it's probably more our problem than his.
Well, you know, don't take too much of the burden on your shoulders here. I mean, a person should be able to do their laundry without having their cat urinate in it. The question is, obviously, why? You know, and good for you for doing all this management, and I would keep that up.
Okay.
But I'd also be asking myself, as I'm sure you are, why is this cat doing this? And there are a couple of explanations, especially in a multi-cat household, the possible explanations grow exponentially. One is it has to do with some kind of social territorial angst, not territorial really, some kind of social tension that might relate to the litter box and the other cats or just the other cats. So I don't know, how many boxes do you have?
We have two boxes.
And how many cats?
Three cats.
Three cats. And where are the boxes, side by side?
They are side by side.
Well, they basically, then you have one box.
Okay.
If you have two boxes side by side, if you have five boxes side by side, you just have one big box with,
one big box,
divisions. Mm-hmm. So either just manage it really carefully or consider trying a box somewhere else and seeing if that's how. I know that's easy for me to say.
Yeah.
But sometimes if you're in a small place, that can be tricky. But that's one thing to try. Another thing to try is sort of the usual litter box litany, is look at the litter. Is it the right litter? I would always, whenever a cat is going outside of the box, I would always take them to a veterinarian.
Okay.
Don't hesitate to do that. In my experience, cats often go on the bed or bedding because they have a physical problem. Mm-hmm. And they're literally trying to tell you, hello, mm-hmm. hello, I've been trying to tell you. I would call today and get an appointment with your vet just to check that out. And there's also that feel away, that pheromone that you can use as a plug-in or a spray. You could try spraying your laundry with this feel away. It has been found in some circumstances to relieve inappropriate urination.
Speaking of scent, do you use a fabric softener?
Yes, we do.
And that, Larry brings up a really good point. That's another possible trigger for your cat.
Mm-hmm.
So you might try doing your laundry without it.
Okay.
You know?
Or an unscented sheet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just something completely unscented, and try an unscented soap as well.
Mm-hmm.
Worth a try, Jen.
Absolutely.
All right.
Got
well,
lots
thank
to
you.
Do.
All
Keep
right.
you busy.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Patricia, thank you. It was a lot of fun again.
Oh, it was great. It was great to be here. We'll be here next week.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. Be sure to visit our website, callingallpets.org. Our new website was designed by Kate Hewson. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0217P and bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with training a new puppy or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or visit our website at callingallpets.org.